Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at 800-LG-TIRES. 800-LG-TIRES.
WIOX is supported by Mountain Flame in Arkville, featuring a range of products for home heating solutions. A variety of fireplaces, wood stoves, and gas and pellet stoves are available and on display. For sales and service, Mountain Flame in Arkville. Warming home since 1980. Details at mountainflame.com.
Hi, I'm Mike.
And I'm Shelia, and we host Pop-Up.
Great pop music from the past, present, and occasionally the future.
Wednesday mornings from 10 to noon and Saturday afternoons from 2 to 4.
Right here on WIOX Roxbury.
Your community radio station, live and local in the Catskill Mountains.
At 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20,
and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local, in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate. If you like what you hear, you can also get WIOX on any smart device through the Radio.fm app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Oh, things are good. Snow's melting out there a little bit. I'm enjoying that.
Yeah, there's a lot of snow out there, and we've been pruning trees, Catskill Forest Association, since January 2nd, and it'll be going until the end of March. And so we've been getting a good survey of not just apple trees, but snow depth. And the winner goes to Claryville, town of Denning, Ulster County.
Oh, man. Up until last week, it was out South Courtright.
South Courtright.
Delaware County.
Absolutely. Yeah, there was a lot of snow up there.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
But town of Denning today, we're pruning trees, and that was very deep, which is to be expected. That place is a different world up there.
Right. What elevation were you pruning up there?
Yeah, between 21, 2200 feet is the valley bottom, but it's got some big mountains around them, and like Slide, Table, Peak of Moose, and it just rains down snow all the time. So.
All right.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of snow. Other than that, today is, I think it reached 50 degrees here.
Yeah. 47, 48, I saw. It was nice to feel that. I think this is the first year I've been thinking of that you and I have tapped and are going to begin boiling on the same run of maple.
First ever. I live at 900 feet in central Ulster County, and John's at, 15, 16?
1600.
1600 in Delhi, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that is very abnormal. So it's shaping up to be a very traditional maple sugaring season. And when I get home tonight, we'll see if the buckets have something in them. But we got a full show tonight. We got to get into it. So tonight we're going to be talking about playing with fire, with New Jersey forester Bob Williams. He's the owner and founder of Pine Creek Forestry. He has an associate's degree in forestry, 1972 from Centralia College, bachelor's in forestry from Rutgers. 43 years of experience in the field of forestry. His experience includes working for Washington State Department of Natural Resources, the U.S. Forest Service in Alaska and Washington, and Scott Paper Company as a logging engineer. Since 1985, Bob has worked as a consulting forester in New Jersey, working with both private and public landowners to achieve management and stewardship goals for natural resources. And let me see if I can get him on. Bob, are you there?
I am here.
All right. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Yeah, so I read your article, Playing with Fire, in Forest Landowner Association magazine, right? That was recently?
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, it's been in the news, right? Fire.
Well, it's a pretty big deal, and we just went through a historical catastrophic event in our western states, so I hope people keep talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the media's been all on it, and when I was in forestry school, we heard reasons why there was going to be catastrophic fires, but today it seems to me, it seems to be mainly we're hearing it about one thing, climate change, but I don't know. We'll go into that tonight. So what's a brief background about fires that you can give us for someone who doesn't know anything about open woods burning or forest fires or whatnot?
Well, I have a lot of experience with both wildfire and prescribed fire, and I just don't think that many folks understand how big a role that fire played in the forest in North America prior to settlement. I think the Native Americans used it on a very large scale frequently, and I think their very existence depended upon it. And those fires really shaped the character and ecology of our landscapes. And my view is the problem is that, particularly in the last 100 years or so, we've really, in a sense, done a good job, but maybe not such a good job in eliminating fires for a lot of good reasons. We all don't want our homes burned up. We don't want our towns burned up. We don't want our timber burned up. We don't, you know, there's a big reason why we fight fires, but that's now all coming home to roost. And we need to start understanding that. We need to do it now.
You talked about Native Americans using fire. Well, for what reasons did they use fire?
Well, their very existence depended upon it. They certainly used it to cook their foods, keep themselves warm, but they also used it in a wide range of things. They used it to manage the land in terms of, they're like us. They understood that keeping forest open made it easier to travel about. They also understood that fires really have a significant impact on the production of berries, things that they ate. They understood how it interrelated with game, deer, elk, you name it, and how, you know, fires maintain forage for animals. They understood how they could herd animals with fire when they were hunting. They understood that fires could control insects. That in turn would affect how animals behaved. So I think they lived in a world of fire that they understood that, you know, the fire was essential to their well-being. I think they used it in war. I think they used it to protect their communities by keeping their approach to their land open with fire. And we have such fire-adapted forests that clearly fire played a big role in how these trees adapted to growing and regenerating. And but I do think we need to look to the Native Americans and how they profoundly shaped the character of the landscape of North America when settlers arrived, they did not find a canopy of big mature trees from coast to coast. They found a very used environment. Native Americans were burning, and it's well documented here in New Jersey as ships approached, it was common to smell smoke, you know. But the relationship with the land, people have to understand that those fires behaved across the entire landscape. So when, if Native Americans were using fire and started a fire for whatever, they certainly understood the seasons and when fires behaved the way they wanted them to and when they didn't. These fires would burn for months on end because the landscape was not fragmented like it is now. And they would burn in a very mosaic, haphazard fashion. And that helped shape the ecology of the land. That's why you see here in New Jersey very patchy sort of forest structure. And that goes back to those times when those fires. And wildfires, in some sense, will behave like that as well. You know, all fire is certainly not the same. And I think people just see fire as, well, it's a good thing if we burn the forest. Well, it really depends on a lot of things. It depends on when the fire occurs, the humidity at that day, the wind that day, the fuel moisture that day, where the fire started. So the diversity of the impact of fire is probably almost indescribable. It's just very diverse. But we do know, at least in my view, fire is essential to the ecology of the land. And then that gets into, as foresters that are managing forests, how do we use fire and learn to live with it? And how do we then integrate silviculture, the management, the actual cutting of trees, in with that to either emulate it or work with it?
Bob, is there a certain forest type in New Jersey or New York that if one saw that you could say this is, you know, an example of a fire adaptable?
Well, certainly not. I've been to New York a few times. There's certainly some pine barrens, and as we have here. Our forest in southern New Jersey are a combination of dominant pitch pine forests, which are certainly fire adapted, and we also have a pretty good component of shortleaf pine that is very extremely fire adapted as well. So, you know, to have those trees that need fire, you know that fire played a role for thousands of years for that adaptation to be in the genes of those trees. So here, you know, we have some forests that I think they do depend on what we call severe stand replacement hot fires, people call them. But I think the dominant fire type that was here, similar to what we see in the southeast with the longleaf pine or the southwest, what we see with the ponderosa pine, these forests that evolved with frequent low-intensity fires where the forests were allowed to grow individual trees for hundreds of years, grow big, get thick bark, be very resistant to severe fire, but be rather open forest. And those open forests either had a shrub understory or herbaceous. You know, that's why we see a lot of herbaceous species in the longleaf pine in the west and here as well. So, you know, and those forests grew over hundreds of years. You have to look at the forest in terms of forest timetables, not our timetables, where we look at forest in terms of our life, you know, or decades. And that's really not how forests evolve. It takes them a long, long time. And I think the pitch pine forest in Long Island and some of the pine barrens in New York certainly are, if not identical to ours, very similar how that pitch pine is very fire dependent. You take away fire, and the forest doesn't do so well. It's the same as, you know, I would say to people, well, what would happen if the rain stopped in the rainforest? It wouldn't be good for it. And the same is with fire. Yeah. And I also think we're seeing more and more evidence how fire also played a role in the hardwood forest. Different, but I do think in terms of how the forest regenerates and so, you know.
What would you say? What would you say to, you know, a lot of people? It seems when I mean, pretty ignorant about fire, but in the East, it seems like our fires are more deliberate, or they have been in the past. Where in the West, they're more prone to have natural fire. I guess I don't know. What do you have to say about all that?
Well, there is a difference. The difference is that in the West, they tend to have more frequent dry. You know, weather conditions and soil and ground conditions that are very susceptible to severe stand replacement type fires. Where here in the East, I think it's a mistake for us to ignore what could happen with fire. But fire would tend to be particularly in our hardwood forest, not so much in our pine forest, but less frequent, so that those major fire events were many, many, many decades between. And what we're so there's the difference. Right now, we're seeing, in my view, in the West, a result of probably 50 years of major change in how the Federal Forest Service has managed forest, and it's allowed this, what I believe to be a very extreme or unnatural buildup of fuel and fuel structure. The forests are extremely overstocked, and they're ready to go. Our forests here in southern New Jersey are in the same condition. They're really not managed. They're protected and preserved, and they're just growing fuel every year. The difference being is we need a sort of the perfect storm. When that fire happens here, everybody in this country is going to hear about it, but it will happen. It's happened in the past. And so there is a difference, I think, in frequency. The severity, you know, we had a fire in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, they killed 16 people and destroyed a town. And so they're going to happen here. But there is a difference.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Playing with Fire with New Jersey forester Bob Williams. Bob, before we go on, what got you into fire, forestry, whatnot? What got you into all this?
I think like a lot of foresters as a kid, I was into hunting. My father was in the woods all the time, and in some ways, I was a shy kid, and I found sanctuary in the woods, and I spent all my time hunting. And my cousin went to New York State Ranger School, and he got a job in Virginia, and one summer I went down there, saw what he was doing, and I spent a summer in Washington State with my uncle, who had loggers as friends, and I actually spent time, that was the first time I ever ran a chainsaw. We were clearing trees in his property, and you know, I was around a logging community, and it just stuck with me, and it's still there. I just like being out in the woods. I like trying to, but, you know, that initial thing, and I think it's a problem for the profession of forestry. Many foresters go in to it because they want to get away from people. You know, it's like, I want to work out there. I don't want to be. But unfortunately, as I've experienced, the brutal criticism of forestry requires that we speak up. Yeah. And I don't think the forestry community has done a really good job at getting to the public with our side of the story, which in large part is based on experience, science, facts, but yeah. We're thrown, I don't know, So I would encourage any young person, they better go and take public speaking, and they better get involved with being able to stand up in front of a crowd and be a professional and sound like you know what you're talking about and mean what you say, because if we don't, this anti-forestry culture that this country is really experiencing is going to continue.
Yeah, I agree. When I was in forestry school, I graduated in 2005 at ESF, and they were teaching even then to hide your work, to put a buffer between
no.
the, and I was like, I always thought that was wrong. Now I'm like, that is no way. You show it off. The farmer doesn't hide his
no.
crops.
If you have to do those kind of things to appease people, you're on the defensive already.
Right.
You know, it's either an acceptable sound environmental practice or it isn't.
Yeah.
Now, you have to, you know, we have what they call the social license to practice forestry. And I keep asking people, well, where do I go and get this license? I got my driver's license. I got a license to buy a gun, but I don't know where to get this. You keep telling me, well, it's sort of an unspoken thing, but we know it's there. The public certainly needs to be informed about what we're doing on the land. And they certainly have a say, in particularly on public land, as to what should or shouldn't occur on that land. And I just don't think forestry has done a very good job of taking the lead on that. We seem to always be on the defensive.
Well, I mean, just the wording is against us, though. Think about it. If we look at public land and call them protected or preserved land as protected, you're already semantically
yeah.
losing the battle, right? Because
yeah,
you're calling it protected.
I remember
looking at a map, and there was some other nonprofit, and they were talking about all the private land being vulnerable. So, well, wait a second. That's not vulnerable. Another way to look at it
right.
is it has options, opportunity. But, you know,
right.
semantics, they kind of matter after a while because they get into people's head, I think. And foresters have lost that battle, I think.
Well, they do. The entire problem with forestry today is a political, social one. It's not a technical or science one. It just is.
Yeah.
You know, our public forests in New Jersey are locked down. And there's no forest industry here, or, you know, there were huge forestry industries in the Pine Barrens and everywhere else. And it's just a misconception that cutting trees is a bad thing. And, you know, it seems like it's a race to buy and lock up the land, which nonprofit can get more than the other one. And, so our land management is signage. Who can put up their sign? You know, this is whatever that trust is or this. And I think we've got to find some way of coming together, of saying, well, look, I'm not suggesting that we're going to cut trees on all the land, because we're not. You know, it's in fact... If the public land was open, I suspect it would be less than 20% of the land that may ever get to be managed with some forestry, for good reason. But it seems like the perception is we want to cut every tree on every square acre that's out there, and that's just not true. It's just not. So my suggestion for the discussion is to start looking at biodiversity. What are we losing? You know, what bird species are in decline? What plant species are in decline? And then just ask the question to who's ever in charge of saying, is that okay?
Right, to be conscious of what you're actually managing for, is what you're saying?
Yeah, well, you know, they're going to go off and say and get into this. They want to keep the discussion on logging or preservation. And that's not my interest. My interest is saying, what are we losing? Which the data is clear, we're losing species. Some species are heading towards extirpation. So once it's admitted that, well, that's a problem, we don't want that, okay, then what are we going to do? Well, the science is going to say, you've got to go out and begin to manage habitat. You know, but we don't have that discussion. It's like, we don't need to cut trees. Well, they're a carbon reserve. We can't cut. Well, okay. Okay, that's your position. But what about this? We're losing biodiversity. We're losing the very thing that was claimed was the reason we set this land aside.
Yeah.
And that's a powerful argument. It's like, that's unacceptable to me. I don't think timber on public land should be a priority in any stretch of the imagination. But in order to sustain those lands, we're going to have to produce timber and let the forest start paying its way of taking care of itself. But it's not driven by the desire to cut timber and make money. It's driven by the desire to do the right thing for the ecology of that land. That's a powerful argument that we would win if it was made.
Yeah, we hear it all the time here. I mean, it seems like weekly or monthly on From the Forest, something like that comes up, set it and forget it, and the forest can manage itself. And, you know, setting it and forgetting it is a management option. Yeah, it is. But at what expense? I think you described that pretty well.
Well, it has to be, you know, I hear that too. And I would say, well, the day for that to work is over, because the fragmentation and the disturbance of the landscape of North America, except for very large areas in the West, where that's fine. I really don't have a problem with setting some land aside and to some degree, but for the most part, these lands have been so disturbed and manipulated. They need our assistance. And having said all that, whether these folks want to believe it or not, to have a viable, healthy economy and a fruitful society, we need wood, and we need a lot of it for all the products that. You can't have the discussion about biodiversity and not talk about the economy. You can't, but they want to. You know, they're pretty successful at that. I'm saying no. You know, we can in this case of forests, we can have it all.
When you say they, who do you mean?
I would say generally not all environmentalists, but extremists who they simply don't want to allow a tree to be cut anywhere at any time for any reason. And that's just a fact. Look at our national forests in the West. You have to be kidding me. Those forests aren't being managed in any stretch of the imagination. Why is that? It's not because foresters in the Forest Service don't want to or aren't trying to. It's the obstruction of the political, social culture of our country.
I mean, just calling him environmentalist. My former boss here at the Catskill Forest Association, he's the kid that he says, I want my term back.
Yeah, well, I mean, and,
you know
just
what I mean?
A term, and I can't.
Yeah.
I mean, I've dealt with this my entire career, and, you know, I've been browbeat and called names, and I know what hate is. I know when I'm sitting in a room and people hate me. You can feel it. You know it. All because I won't give in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to give in. I think I have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of acres I can walk today and tell people, here's what was done there and when it was done, and it's beautiful. And it's thriving with endangered species. And all those things are not happening in spite of me. They're happening because of me.
Yeah,
and somehow, you know. On the other hand, I think some private land, if a landowner wants to manage his forest intensely, and what have you, I think they should be allowed to. I mean, they can't pollute streams and do bad things, but you know, they shouldn't be held up because, well, you know, we want you to, whatever. You know, it's like, come on, folks. And if we can't find a way to work together in terms of taking care of our forest, then I think we're in real big trouble.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Playing with Fire with New Jersey forester Bob Williams. So, Bob, we have the 2020 wildfires in the West. What was the first thing that came to your mind when you heard of these?
I'm not surprised. why would somebody be surprised?
Yeah. Well, wasn't either, but, you know, to the non-forestry public, I think a lot of people get the idea that this is mainly due to climate change. Do you think that's true, or do you think it's a mixture of cultural changes, lack of forestry? What do you think? Why do you think they occur?
Well, I think it's a very – that is not a simple answer to that question. I think both sides are yelling at each other, and they're both wrong. We did have catastrophic fires in the past. This, you know, it's not like it's never happened. You can't say that all the forests in North America were perfectly maintained for thousands of years. This is not true. But on the other hand – if you're going to make decisions that dramatically change the structure of the forest that creates optimum or excessive fuel loads, you shouldn't be surprised when this happens. It's a result of your decision. And to say we need to go out and log all the forest and we need to thin all the forest and this is the environmentalist's fault. That's not true.
Right.
It's everybody is to blame here. It was the Forest Service that went into this fire policy for 100 years, and they got it wrong. Put out every fire or do this. There was no – in my early years, no one ever talked to me about fire ecology or how fire behaved in the forest, and we need to – when I worked in the West, I fought fires for 2 years on a helicopter crew, and our job was to snuff them out as fast as we can, and that's what we did.
Why did that happen in the last 100 years? We've had Stephen Pine on from Arizona, and what's your take on that? Why did that take off?
It was really the result of that big burn, I guess it was in 1910 or whatever, when I forget how many people were killed in Idaho. Really, really horrible fire. And Gifford Pinchot, and folks went to war against fire. And where we messed up was along the line, we should have learned that, you know, it's a combination of we have to decide what we want from the forest. And that's a term from my friend Jim Peterson of the Evergreen Foundation. What do you want from your forest? And, we want clean water. We want trout stream. You know, it's a broken record. We want all this. And then we let this happen. It's like, well, wait a minute. There's something wrong. So how it happened was a combination of certainly fire was perceived as a demon. Their movie Bambi and Smokey the Bear, you know, that was our culture, that we got to protect the land from fire. And it's come home to roost. It really has. And we have great fire scientists and foresters that have done tremendous research over the last 50, 60 years. Now we know a lot now. We should be able to look at the land and say, well, here's where we need silviculture. Because a lot of forests, you know, a lot of people, well, we'll just make more prescribed burning. That'll solve it. No, it won't. It's not going to solve it. First off, there's a lot of land that's just too dangerous to even try and prescribe burn. You're never going to drop a torch there. You're crazy. So we have to treat the forest mechanically before. And we certainly could get forests in shape where they could be fire safe for a very long time. And we could prescribe burn fairly easily and frequently. We in the southeast here, we could be teaching folks out west. We use fire all the time. And our hazard is pretty high. It's not like anybody could burn there. Well, anybody can't burn here. But it's a complex problem. And we're just not coming together on it. We're just not, in my view. You know, we just had a legislative hearing where they want to pass certain laws that help prescribe burning and sort of legislate that the state agencies do X, you know, burn 50,000 acres. Well, they can't burn 50,000 acres. Look out the window, there's a snowpack. We don't get enough days in a year that we could burn that. You know, why doesn't that legislation say, why don't we manage and prep 50,000 acres a year because of our concern from wildfire. I mean, if you flew over southern New Jersey and saw the fire hazard and how tens of thousands of houses are neatly tucked into those woods, you'd be like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? Stephen Pine has been here, too, and has said that. Don't they understand what's going to happen? I don't know.
That's the other problem, right? I mean, a fire isn't necessarily hazardous if there's no property around, just as a tree that's can't be hazardous in the woods if there's no house nearby. But now there are houses, right? There's houses in Chaparral out west. There's houses in Pitch Pine. I mean, right? I don't know.
Well, that's another problem that is in the complexity of this is, you know, we unfortunately may have to be, you know, it's a property rights thing. You know, there may be areas where we shouldn't be building houses, you know. Now, I know a lot of private landowners get their back up if I say that, but it's the same as a flood hazard. We don't let you build a home where there's a 50 or 100-year flood or what have you. So it just throws into the – makes it more complex. But the thing that is unacceptable to me is those folks are there now, and we actually have extremists who say, well, if they get burned out, they shouldn't be allowed to rebuild their home. And I don't accept that. No, we have an obligation to take care of these lands around – those areas, and you know, those lands could be productive in providing our forest products, and there's going to be plenty of wild land left to burn.
Yeah, and also, I mean, on the private sector side of things, as far as flooding goes, as far as I know, there's no private flood insurance. It's all FEMA backed, isn't it by the government? I mean,
I think, but I don't know.
Yeah, we're familiar with it a little bit here in the Catskills because our streams flood all the time when there's a big rain. But we're going to take a break right now. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking to New Jersey Forester Bob Williams about fire. And we're going to ask him some more questions when we return. All right. That's Smoke on the Water. That song's all about the bass line, no?
Boom, 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 boom.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight, we are talking about Playing with Fire with New Jersey forester Bob Williams. Go ahead, John.
All right, Bob. Yeah, we've talked a lot about you know, mismanagement, but do you have any specific examples, especially on public land and where? You know, leaving the forest alone for the last 40, 50, 100 years is done, and why and how?
Well, use a couple examples here in southern New Jersey where we've locked up land and excluded fire. And lo and behold, what happens? You get a more denser forest, a heavy, heavy, heavy understory, and the species of plants and animals and birds that are dependent upon maybe more open forest or areas that are more herbaceous, what have you, they're gone. You know, forest maturation in lieu of having fire in a fire-adapted ecosystem is just not good, you know, in my view. Now, you could have a discussion about, well, the fires will come someday. The problem with that is some of these species, once they're gone, they're not coming back. So my view is in these fire-adapted forests, our situation is almost very similar to the ponderosa pine in Arizona, where there's been a lot of work by scientists out there, the need to you know, thin those forests and get prescribed fire back in them. So that management decision, say, we aren't going to do anything, we're just going to leave this alone, is creating, in my view, some forest decline, forest degradation, what have you. We have forests here where the New Jersey Forest Fire Service, who does a wonderful job, applies fire, prescribed fire, and their real purpose is not ecologically, it's to reduce fuel loads, keep the forest black, you know. But doing that, you can go out and see forests that have been locked up for 100 years or so. And, you know, those forests are what I believe are slowly recovering. So there's evidence that, you know, in some places we don't need to be cutting trees. You know, forests grew before and they can grow. The problem is striking a balance in a forest plan where we understand that's happening there, that's great, we're not going to thin. Over here, we need to thin. And that's called a forest management plan, which you both know well. The problem is we don't have any forest management plans for our forest in South Jersey or public lands. We just don't. You know, they're just there. Well, we're going to do a plan. You know, we're going to do an inventory. Well, I've heard that for 30 years. You know, I've heard it probably since I was a boy. So, you know, the planning of how we're going to manage the forest needs to be very carefully looked at. And all these differences need to be applied with, in my view, on public land, but the optimum of the ecological integrity of the land. And then we can dovetail other things in. Well, here, you know, we have a retirement community, and we've really got to thin this forest. These people are at such a high risk. And we can do all those things, but we don't. And I think in the West, there's still a struggle. To be honest with you, after this catastrophic historical fire season, I don't think they're going to do a damn thing out there. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to sit around and wring their hands and have commissions and point fingers, and the next community is going to burn up too. You know, we just have this, I've said it before, this political, social, culture that doesn't allow for decision making and compromise, getting together, coming together, and that's just my view of it. But the forest, it needs it. Don't we care about recreational opportunities? I thought we did. You know, that's a huge priority in our national forest.
I feel like fire too, Bob, is like the direct opposite of our culture today. And what I mean by that is we're such a risk-averse culture today. And fire is so, you know, it's perceived as spontaneous, and it mostly is, I think. You can't pinpoint fire, right? There's things that happen, weather, whatever, that can happen that you can't predict. It's just, I don't know, it's...
It's a scary thing.
Yeah.
And make no mistake, it's a dangerous thing. When we go out and do prescribed burns, it's a dangerous thing, and there's a lot of that goes into it, and people like me that are responsible are really concerned. It's like we've got to do this right. And it could be as little as you smoke out a subdivision, and all the people are going to sue you because they want all new furniture. They may not be burned up. That could happen as well. So, you know, there's some real liability problems with starting to throw fire all over the place. So that's where, you know, forest science and silviculture has got to play a role. You know, we've got to allow the cutting of trees. I hear all this, fires are great, and, you know, just – let it burn out. It's like, well, we're never going to burn our way out of this problem. We're not. And air pollution, you know, the permitting that goes into, you know, you want to set fire? You're kidding me. And with the current explosion of the concern about climate change, that issue is going to get bigger and bigger. But just getting the land and putting little signs up and locking it away is leading to just nothing but disaster.
Yeah. Well, but it fits into this precautionary principle thing. That, you know, the problem with forestry, cutting trees, burning, is that it spits in the face of the precautionary principle, which a lot of environmentalists have embraced, that if you can't prove it to be 100% safe, don't do it. And you can never do anything 100% safe.
No, you can't. And it's, and we're talking about our home, our country, our state here in the East, but it's a worldwide issue. It's not limited to fires exploding around the planet. And I'm not a climatologist, so I can't. I do think things are changing. I think we should be concerned, and I try to do my best with, you know, in my career, I've planted millions of trees, and I walk through forests today, and I'm amazed at myself, that look at this land, you know, and we could be doing more of that, but it seems like the predominant thing is, no, leave it alone, don't touch it. You know, human beings are bad. In the United States, we're going to have 50 more million people in a few years, not less people. You think they're going to use less resources?
Yeah.
You think they're going to want to go out and recreate less?
Yeah.
And the forest, the one thing we did do right in the United States, I think, is we did keep a lot of land protected from conversion to other uses. And I support that. I do. Where we failed is we then don't look at the land and say, okay, what do we want from that land? What is our obligation to make sure Mother Nature is doing okay? We just don't.
So what are some examples? And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and tonight we're talking about playing with fire with New Jersey forester Bob Williams. So we're running out of time. We got about a little less than 5 minutes. What are some examples of success?
Well, I think there's lots of examples of success. I would use some of the work here in South Jersey where we've thinned and burned both pitch pine and shortleaf pine forests. The forests are magnificent. aesthetically, biologically, you know, endangered species. I've seen that throughout Northern California. There's a company out there, I forget their name, the Big Pine Company, and the work they're doing, the Southeast, the Ponderosa Pine. Dr. Covington has done great research on the thinning and burning of those forests. We see it in examples in eastern Washington. I've been to Idaho. The problem is that the scale of the work simply isn't large enough to really have a positive effect across the landscape. But there are plenty of great examples of how we're starting to pull this together across the entire United States.
Yeah, that,
and one more thing, the great longleaf pine restoration in the Southeast. How fabulous is that, where they're thinning and burning and getting the longleaf pine ecosystems back. It's just a wonderful thing, and they produce a lot of lumber.
And longleaf pine, is there another common name, hard pine? I'm not really familiar with longleaf
pine. No, longleaf pine is a very special pine ecosystem. There's about 90 million acres of that at settlement. I think we have like 6 million acres left.
Wow.
And probably about 10 years or so, a bunch of folks put together the Longleaf Pine Initiative to restore it. And that program is really, you know, it's kind of converting the pine plantations of industry back to the native, which I think is a really great, great story. And I wish we could do more of that here in our state, bring back our shortleaf and pitch pine. I'm a big believer in public land and letting those trees grow to be very big and old.
Bob, you said there was 90 million longleaf pine at settlement. If longleaf pine are fire dependent, doesn't that kind of indicate that Native Americans were burning a lot?
Absolutely. That's why I just believe that. And the Native Americans didn't stop burning the pine forest at Virginia, where the limit of longleaf range. So don't tell me that the Native Americans in New Jersey or New York didn't understand how pine systems work. They did, and there's just tons and tons of evidence that Native Americans were big time land managers. They just were. You know, this whole myth that, you know, this is just a pristine, untouched, Native Americans, there were millions of people trying to survive, and they used the land to their advantage, but yet they understood how to work with the land, as opposed to modern society. Is no doubt about it, we can abuse land.
Well, it's a myth that keeps giving, I guess, and it's still pretty popular today. But hopefully we'll turn it around, right, and educate and raise awareness. It's about all. Go ahead, sorry.
I would leave you with one thing. If people are interested in this fire issue, there's a new book out. It's called First Put Out the Fire. It's by Jim Peterson of the Evergreen Foundation, and that is just – that explains all this far more than I ever would be able to. It's a historical view of it, it's a science view of it, and it's a social political view of it. And what that man did with that book, to me, is like, I wish more people would just get it and read it, and let's get together and start taking care of our forests.
What is that, First Put Out the Fire, by who?
James D. Peterson.
James
Peterson. Of the Evergreen Foundation. Get it.
Yeah. Just wrote it down. Well, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time, Bob.
Okay, it's been great, and there's other subjects. Maybe we'll do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay.
All right.
Good luck.
Thank you. Take care.
Yep.
If you just missed the show, that was New Jersey forester Bob Williams talking about fire, its historical importance, and maybe how to deal with it in the future. But that's all the time we have on From the Forest, and have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the
drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river